This is FUV Live Sessions, a podcast brought to you by WFUV in New York City. Each week, we talk to artists in our Bronx studio and we listen to them play a live set. You'll get to hear the songs and learn about the artist or band. Episodes drop every Monday wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on all the latest episodes and maybe even to find your next favorite artist or band. And if you like what you hear, make sure that you rate and review the show so other music lovers can find it. This is FUV Live Sessions with Laura Marling. I'm Megan Aftermat, and I'm here with host Kara Manning at WFUV. Kara, I think something that's really special about this session is that you've been an ardent fan and following Laura since the very beginning of her career. What's it like to kind of watch someone's journey over that period of time?
Well, I think as I had said to her in our interview, the privilege of watching her over 16 years. From the first time I saw her at the Sidewalk Cafe, which is no more in New York City, and she was just terrified. You could just see this very shy teenager. And I had booked her at the time to appear on Vince Gelso's Idiot's Delight, too, because there was something about her. You just knew. Sometimes artists come along and you just know that there's something incredibly special about them. And she was somebody who was that very thing. If you have never seen Laura Marling perform live, you are missing out on watching not only a brilliant singer-songwriter, but one of the best guitarists playing today. She takes you on a journey when she performs, and you follow her every word, every nuance, every gesture, with just, I can gush endlessly about her because I'm that impressed by who she is. And now watching her as a woman in her early 30s with a little baby and writing one of this glorious new album, Patterns and Repeat, which is about family. It is about making that choice to have a baby and what that means and how you sort of accept those sacrifices and the freedom to make those sacrifices if you have that ability in your life to do that. It was a really great conversation with her. She just played three songs solo today, but it felt like you were watching an entire concert from her because she brings you that closely and intimately into her world and what she needs to say.
Let's listen to one of those now. What's the first thing that we're going to hear in the session?
She's actually going to begin today with Patterns, which is the second song from the album Patterns and Repeat. There's also another song called Patterns and Repeat, and we talk a bit about the companionship of those two songs. This is Laura Marling on FUV Live Sessions with Patterns.
Your toes, your family nose hangs around. You're still a ballerina, everybody knows. Your feet are on the ground. Begin to have your children, your flock of birds, your branch among the wood. You'll try to tell them, but you're lost. at first, abstract, too soon, contract in the form. And now the time leaps by and starts to fly, and only then can I see that we're patterns in repeat.
I'm Kara Manning with FUV Live Sessions, and that is Laura Marling with Patterns from her new album, Patterns in Repeat, Laura's first release in 4 years. Laura made her WFUV debut on Vince Gels' Idiot's Delight back in the winter of 2008, and back then she was a shy, chain-smoking teenager who had an intuitive, uncanny way of writing and stepping into the sinews of a song that felt entirely novel, although she would likely brush off such praise. Since that first visit 16 years ago, Laura has been a frequent, beloved guest here at WFUV. We have had FUV live conversations multiple times in this studio over the years with her. It has been a gift to witness her artistic passage through her teens, 20s, and now early 30s. Laura's new 8th album, Patterns in Repeat, was released in October, and it parallels a new phase of Laura's life as the parent of a baby daughter. But it's not just an album about being a new mother. Through 11 songs, Laura muses on a kaleidoscope of patterns in repeat through her family and friends, with arresting beauty, incisive lyricism, and a commanding serenity. She asks us to slow down, experience granular moments, and even the small miracles that life delivers, even when we face distressing times. Laura Marling, welcome back to WFUV. We have really missed you. I have really missed you. And I'm so happy you are here with this gorgeous record.
Oh, thank you so much. That was such an amazing introduction. Thank you.
It's funny, though, because I did see that you wrote in your Substack that speaking to journalists for promotion and is that you believe that you were scatty, evasive, mild mannered, internally unsure of what I wrote or what you write about. You don't like this part of the I guess of the process of talking to journalists about new albums. It's really rough.
I feel more than I dislike it, well, rather than disliking it, it feels that I'm not very good at it. But having said that, every country is different doing promo, and in America, particularly American radio, you get much more sort of thoughtful and sincere questions than you do anywhere else in the world. So I'm very happy to be.
Oh, that's good.
That seems to be my observation from doing.
Oh, that's
radio
good. People who actually have taken the time to listen to the entire album. And
yes, that's always
about
nice.
It. Always helpful. Yeah. Patterns is just such a beautiful song, and I'm glad we're beginning with it. And I did wonder in listening to it, because there's a song that's later in the album called Patterns in Repeat. Did they begin as deliberate companions, or was that one song that sort of evolved and split into two courses of thought for you?
Yes, it started as one chord progression that then had a refrain that ended up being used in two different songs, basically. And one was written at the very beginning of writing the album, and one was the one that finishes it was written at the very end of writing it. So it was a way of legitimizing not having written two songs.
You know, about a month before you gave birth to Maudie, your mm-hmm. daughter, you finished your thesis in psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. which is huge. Mm. Then you gave birth to a beautiful child, and then you began writing this album. Mm. But you didn't intend to be writing songs. It just sort of happened while you were at home.
Yes.
Tending to the baby.
Yeah, I guess guitar or piano, or maybe particularly guitar and piano, are actually quite accessible mediums when you've got tiny baby, just one tiny baby, crucially. I know I'm not able to speak on having multiple children, but you know, when they're really tiny and they're bouncing in a bouncer, and if they're happy, they're happy. You can do things like that don't upset them too much, like playing the guitar and the piano. And that completely surprised me. Because I guess in some respect, I thought that becoming a parent was going to take away your desire in quite a lot of respects.
And you had doubts about even being a parent.
I was very ambivalent about it. It wasn't on my top list of priorities, which, I, you know, it's a boring thing to say, but now seems so crazy because it was such an extraordinary experience. But I was worried about it taking away from my interest in creativity and art and music. And it just couldn't have been further from that, in my experience. It was a real honing in of the like immense power and beauty of art and creativity, both as a consumer of it and as a, you know, participant in it in some way.
And Patterns, was that the song that was written on a Paris hotel room balcony?
That was Patterns in Repeat.
Yeah. Oh, that was Patterns in Repeat, which is the companion to that.
Yeah.
Because traveling with the baby and being at home, you have a home studio.
Yes.
It sort of made it easy that when you felt the need to, I would assume that the music came initially and then the lyrics followed in suit, or did it go the other way around? But
I mean, for this album, it was sitting down and playing. There is a musical theme throughout the album that repeats a couple of times, and it was that sort of became the backbone of the album. That quite often happens, that you find a kind of new sonic thing that intrigues you. And that trip that where I ended up writing that song, it was our first kind of trip away where we had to stay in a hotel quite last minute because it was for a funeral. So we had to do it very quickly without thinking too hard, which is always a disaster with a baby. But I did have the foresight at least to be like, wherever we're going under whatever the circumstances, I take my guitar with me, which is a massive annoyance when you've already got a million other things. Anyway, it was well worth it. And I think that's the kind of the agreement I've made with myself, is that you still take the guitar with you wherever you go, as well as the million of other things that you have in excess with a baby.
She is now, what, about a year and
she's
a half?
She's two, yeah. She's nearly two,
she's
yeah.
She's nearly two.
Yeah.
So you have made the decision to limit. I was lucky enough to see you at Hackney Church in London play, and you split the set with older songs in the beginning, and then you play this album in its entirety with a band and with the Deep Throat Choir, who were wonderful. But you were limiting deliberately your touring. You are here now in New York to do an equivalent residency at Bowery Ballroom.
Yes.
Is that you are really quite determined that you really don't want to do very much?
Yeah.
You've changed the rules in your life about what touring is.
Yes. And I think that is it immediately becomes politically charged conversation when I say what I'm about to say, which is that, one, as you said in your introduction, I've been doing this for 16 years. So I'm incredibly fortunate enough to be able to say, actually, you know, that particular economic necessity from the past, I can take a break from that for a few years and survive. So that's an amazing, you know, just factor of my life. But also, it seems to me, without prior knowledge, because I didn't realize that this was going to be the great privilege of my life, but I get to spend every day with my daughter. And I didn't think that was going to be such a important thing to me. I thought, you know, I'll carry on working afterwards and in the way that I have been doing, but I couldn't want to do that less, which is difficult. That is a difficult tension, because I have made that an album, which is great. I had time to do that, had a home studio to do that in. All of these things that are privileges, fortunate privileges, have afforded me this choice.
Right. And your artwork too, because I'm going to ask you about that a bit later, but I was sort of stunned to read that your artwork has made you almost more money than some of the streaming on your albums has.
We'll get into that later.
So at one point, though, when you were writing all of these songs, Your Girl, Child of Mine, Looking Back, which is a song that I want to ask you about with your dad, when did you feel that I'm actually writing an album and maybe I should reach out to Dom Monks and Rob Moose and start talking to them about the fact of, well, I didn't expect to be doing this, but I seem to have an album?
Well, I wrote Child of Mine, which is the first song on the album, maybe when she was like 6 or 7 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that took me by surprise. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll just carry on, see where I can get to. And it went quite quickly. The songs came together quite quickly. And at about 3 months, when she was about 3 months, I spoke to Dom, who I've worked with on all my albums apart from one, as an engineer, and now he's more of a producer in his own right. But he also has four kids.
Does he really? Yeah. Wow.
So he was not only the person I wanted to work with, but he was also a perfect person to work with because he knew the sort of chaos of the circumstances under which I was living. So I had done quite a lot of the recording of the main body of work alone. But when he came to stay at my house, and we worked basically in half an hour intervals between her napping and waking up, and he set up in the living room and I'd run up and put it down for a nap and we'd record a couple of things. And then, you know, it was total chaos, and I could have only done it with someone I've known for 10 years. And he was like holding her while I was doing takes. It was amazing. And then Rob Moose was in London that summer, and I saw him for dinner and I was like, I just want you to do all of the arrangements. I want this to be as simple as possible. I want you to do the arrangements. I'll do the backing vocal arrangements and me and Dom will do the rest. And that's kind of, it was all about simplicity. I mean, Rob is an incredible person to have do that. So yeah, it was lucky. I just called in basically the old guard.
And obviously Dom has worked with Big Thief, and yes. Buck Meek is on Child of Mine.
Yes.
And it was Maudie's first concert was seeing
Buck Meek. We went to a Buck Meek concert, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, so was that before he knew he was going to be on this album?
Yeah.
So you reached out to him after that and asked him.
Yeah, so when she was really little then, but he was in town and I had planned, I thought maybe I was going to be able to go to that gig. That was naive. So I asked if I could bring her to the sound check. So we put some ear defenders on and she came. So it was just us.
I love that.
Yeah, it was so nice. Yeah.
That's lovely. And I just love the fact that you've left sounds and textures in that song, because you hear Maudie in the beginning and you can, and throughout the entire album, it just feels like we're sitting with you and you're in your living room or in, you know.
Yeah.
It's a wonderfully intimate record. I mentioned earlier that your father was a sort of not an unwilling collaborator, but he sort of dropped the idea of using his lyrics for Looking Back, which you found in a trunk, or how did you discover something that he had written?
Well, he always plays it on the guitar whenever he, throughout our lives, my sisters and I, like our lives, that's always been the song he sort of played when he picked up the guitar, Looking Back. So we were quite familiar with it, but we were doing transfer. He used to run a recording studio, so he used to have a whole massive sort of garage full of reel-to-reel tapes. And when we were transferring them a couple of years ago, this one really stood out as being, I don't know, a proper song. I mean, he used to be a songwriter as well, but this song in particular from the original recording sounded sort of, yeah, it was special.
And it falls into the familial quality of this, you know.
Yes.
Because as a new parent, it made you, I would imagine, regard your own parents in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, totally. Like a total revelation about what it meant to be a parent.
Yes. So
what was something that you walked away from in the beginning that struck you that you maybe never realized as a daughter looking at her parents?
In simple terms, when I had my daughter and I looked at her for the first time, I realized how much my mother loved me. You know, like how much you were loved. It's breathtaking. All people under the right circumstances were probably loved that way instantly. And that changes everything. It's just sort of unquestioning. It makes all of the questioning seem sort of useless. Because obviously things can feel like they interrupt that love throughout your life or feel like it gets more complicated. But at the base, there is this profound, instant, enormous love. And that really set a new perspective for me.
I love that. Caroline sounds, the narrator of Caroline sounds it comes from a different place or era or time, and you sing a song I only just remember in terms of that, and it's a playful song too, but it is interesting because it seems to be not you, or is it you?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's one of those ones that arrived out of kind of nowhere. Yeah, it's clearly not me because I'm not an old person reflecting on their life, but like I guess in this context, in this position that I was in on thinking about the miraculous structure of family. Like, it is for a family to stay together over the course of raising children is a miracle. It's a very hot, it's a very dedicated process. And my parents are still together. And you think anything could interrupt that. Anything could change that. And of course, it's not the end of the world if it does, but it's a perfect dramatic setting for what if something erupted from the past and you think, oh, hang on, that never actually was that far from me. I could have made that choice at any point in my life, and maybe this is the time that I make it. And it seems very high stakes all of a sudden when you have a family, because there is a necessary repression of desires. Not, I don't mean sexual desires particularly, I mean of freedom, the desire for freedom. You have to repress that desire because you have something much more important than you that needs your devotion. And that is not a sacrifice. It's a new responsibility, basically. And a great dramatic plot point for songwriting.
Very much so. Kara Manning, I'm here with Laura Marling on WFUV, and from her new album, Patterns and Repeat, this is Caroline in Studio A.
What a way to change an evening. Was my number hard to find? You know, I'd given up believing, though the song had somewhat lingered on my mind. It went la 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 la, something something Caroline. Caroline, you're like an ember, a rock that bursts back into life, song I only just remember that goes, oh, something, something, Caroline. La, 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 something, something, Caroline. Caroline, we're old now. I got married and I loved my wife. Kids, they're good and grown now. All in all, I've been happy with my life. For I was never really far from you, was I? Something, something, Caroline.
That is Laura Marling with Caroline on FUV Live Sessions. She is here in Studio A, returning again to WFUV. Her brand new album, Patterns and Repeat, is out now. And I just love watching your guitar work. You are one of the great guitarists, in my estimation, of anyone that I've ever seen walk in this studio. And this particular guitar that you're playing today, a mirror guitar, has a very interesting history, which I don't know if you really want to talk about or not.
It's charged with a past. Yeah, I took it. It wasn't even me who took it. It was my friend who went to pick up my stuff from an ex-boyfriend, a flat I used to share with my ex-boyfriend. And she, I told her to take his guitar, and she did. And now it's mine.
And now it's mine. Yeah, now 15 years. And it was this the guitar on which you wrote the bulk of this record on?
Yes.
Or it was?
Yeah, yeah.
What is it about the sound or its feel or its emotional resonance for you that makes it such a compelling instrument?
Well, it's a nylon string guitar. So a well-crafted nylon string guitar's resonance is amazing. Very, you know, you can get a lot of vibrato out of a nylon string. And I've written most of my records on either that guitar, or I have a Martin M36 from the 80s that's beautiful as well. And they're my two guitars that I always have out, and they're not the greatest guitars to play live because they don't microphone very well, but they're my guys. My two guys.
Interlude, Time Passages, is a really interesting instrumental track on this record. It reminds me a little bit of the work you did with Mike Lindsay in Lump.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, because it is very different from everything else on the record, and where it came from, because it has some tension to it.
Yeah, I did that before, well, while I was pregnant, before I had my daughter. There came a certain point when I was pregnant where I couldn't actually play the guitar anymore because I couldn't get my arm around it, you know, physically. And so I was just sort of in my studio noodling on other things. And I had this, I can't remember what it's called, this piano. It's called like a Five Dimensions of Touch piano. It's a new invention. Anyway, it was dreadful. It was broken. I bought it new, but the glue had degraded. And I had this weird like back and forth with the company where I was like, they don't fix things. This is a boring story. But anyway, they don't fix things. So it has no after plan. So you're supposed to throw it in the bin if it doesn't work. So I had this very toxic relationship with this new bit of kit. And I was determined to make some use out of the fact that it was broken anyway. So you're supposed to do all of these sort of five dimensions of touch things with it. It means you can wobble the strings. It means you could, you know, change the volume and the timbre of the piano or whatever. And what I ended up using it for was basically using the glitch, the broken bit, which had, you just couldn't get a straight note out of this particular area of the piano. And that became this glitchy sound of this instrumental MIDI track.
So segueing it, though, making sure that it had a place in the album.
Yeah, because it had this weird, I was thinking about doing an instrumental album. I was like, well, I won't have any lyrics to write after the baby's born, so, because nothing will have happened. You know, it's so ridiculous. So I was like, well, I'll do an instrumental album. I'll do sort of instrumental guitar and try and mix it with some. And anyway, seeing if I could tell a story without lyrics. And that one was my only sort of success, because it went from A to B. It went through a lifetime, it felt. Yeah. And so that's how it came about.
I found it so compelling to have that sort of almost breaking the album into side A, side B.
I really
ways.
Had to convince Dom.
Really?
it wasn't random.
He was resistant initially.
Don't get it.
And so now you have somebody who asked you about it, so you can say, Dom, someone asked me about it, and they were interested in it. I was also shocked and dismayed to read, because you have a new Substack that you started not that long ago, mm-hmm. because, and I was, and a longer story, but the you do not own the rights to your first five albums, mm-hmm. that you wrote a very long entry, which just so dismayed me. You do own the rights to your last three albums, including this one. And that you also said that you have made more money out of the prints that you do and out of the Substack now than you have in album sales, because you were in such a bad major label deal.
Yes. Yeah.
Early on.
Yeah.
To sort of figure that all out, where you are now, do you... You don't foresee doing a Taylor Swift kind of situation at this point and maybe re-recording things? I mean, that seems to be tremendous to do rather than just moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I could do that. Taylor Swift is in obviously a different position because she has had a lot more success. I don't know if anyone's noticed that, but she's quite a bit more successful than me. And I, you know, if I had stayed on that, if I had been wildly successful on a major label deal, I would be obviously in a very different economic position. But if you are a mildly successful person on one of those horrendous deals, of which that many people are, not anymore, I don't think, but there were a few people I know, friends who are songwriters, are on very similar deals, or signed them around the time I did. That was an era of where they were putting clauses into, just before streaming basically, where they were putting clauses saying if record labels exist on the moon, or when record labels exist on the moon, you will still not get your rights back, as in like nothing that changes in the world will affect your ability to get your rights back, which is scary, crazy, but you know, it is what it is. So in some ways I sort of feel maybe I will do that when I have time. The other thing is time to do that, re-record everything. But in some ways I just feel like, well, just is what it is.
Yeah,
you know, I recorded them how I wanted to record them. So and in many ways, I was lucky. And in some ways, one massive way, I was really unlucky.
I was just completely depressed to read that. And I wouldn't, you know, I'm glad that you have now a Substack in which you, a lot of your art is represented. on that Substack as well.
Mm.
Visual arts have taken like an entire sort of cottage industry in your home as well. So which I find wonderful. And what draws you to that? That is different from songwriting for you.
Well, I mean, the type of, it'd be a slight stretch to call it art, but I make these prints that I sell that are related to the artwork of the albums that I've released. And I do them all by hand. I have a sort of a manual printing press, and I used to have a studio specifically to do them. I used to do commission work for other people as well. And it's very repetitive, and it's very, you know, the precision of, I just like, it's the antithesis of sort of creative work in a way, because it's just precision, repetition, and you feel tired at the end of the day. Your back feels tired. I like having that. I used to go and work on farms and things in between. When I came back from tour, I used to go and work on farms. And it was like the perfect antidote to being on tour, because you just had to work all day and you were tired at the end of the day. And that's all I really want. And then having children will do that for you as well.
I was going to say, yes. It seems that you have you went through so much when you were in your 20s and in California, and you write quite beautifully on Substack about some of your mystical experiences and what songwriting is. In coming through that and returning home to London, it seems that what is most important for you is a sense of normalcy.
Yes.
And to put priority on things that really matter to you, that you want to do. So how do you sort of see or envision your life in 5 years? Do you made one comment to the Guardian that you don't even know if you want to keep recording music. You're not sure about that.
I always say that.
You do.
I sort of catch myself saying that. I think, oh God, you've said that before. I always feel like that after I've recorded and put out an album, because it's such an effort. Like, it's such a, like, doing this album, it's maybe not that interesting to talk about, but like trying to pull together all these abstract things is such an insane task. And then to do it, and then you have to wait 6 months to put it out. I don't know. My life is now based around these chapters of experience that come out in songs. And I'm so happy with that as a lifestyle. So I think it will, you know, my life's path is kind of set, hopefully all being well. But in order to do that, I need to, live a normal life. I mean, that's not like I live a boring life. I live the way I'd like to live. You know, at the moment, that's raising children. And in a few years' time, I'm reassured, it won't all be about that.
Yeah, right. What about the MA in psychoanalysis? Are you planning on doing? Because you just completed your thesis not that long ago.
Yeah.
So is that something that you would like to continue?
Maybe. I think what doing that, because that was the foundation, the course that I did, the MA that I did, was basically what counted towards a foundation year of the full training in the British system of psychoanalytic training. And there were only two people who were going on to do that in my course of 30. And they were, both spoke three languages and were like just miles brighter than anybody else. But, you know, but that is, it's not to say, I think either you need to be unbelievably bright and speak three languages, because it's all about the exchange and potential exchange of particular meaning of words in psychoanalysis, or you need, you know, at least 60 years life experience. So maybe later on in life that'd be interesting. But for me, it was just that, you know, to do that course, to understand things a bit more in depth, it was just a real, you know, it enriched my ability to read the world, I think, and it's particularly art and literature, in a way that I just found interesting.
Did it bleed into the album in some way? I mean, were things that you could pluck from what you had discovered on that journey find its way into this record?
I think the idea of the family drama, you know, that there is this profound drama that takes place in your life, and it's all based around your family, and you just basically reprint that on other people for the rest of your life. I found that quite funny, you know, like you are just basically, you know, you've got mummy and daddy issues for the rest of your life, you know, that is it. And I find, like, there's lots about psychoanalysis that I really love it. I say this with profound love and yearning to understand it further and further for the rest of my life. But I find it funny how seriously it takes itself and how desperate it is to be seen as a science when it's obviously not possible to contain it under those rules. But it's poetry to me, you know, like the way that it reads family dynamics, family drama, the internal worlds, the function of desires and things like that. You know, I love it. It's poetry. So I sort of take it all with a pinch of salt, basically.
Back in 2020, you released Song for Our Daughter, a song in particular, long before you would thought you would be having a daughter. Is there any lyric, when you look back at that song, that you would add now, having now been a mother, writing a song for your daughter?
I think that now that I think about that album, you know, it, which was Conjecture, obviously.
Yeah.
I see that I was writing to an older girl, you know, a woman, an early stages of womanhood girl. So I haven't, you know, it would be an entirely different thing to, because, you know, kids are kind of genderless when they're born, you know. People always think Morty's the boy. I'm like, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter at this stage at all. So it becomes, as you enter into the socio-political sphere, you don't really, that happens later. So there was no real, you know, my Song for Our Daughter was mostly a commentary on that, the kind of construction of womanhood.
It's interesting, you being in New York at this time, at the time that we're speaking, the election has just happened here in the United States. And I very complicated week to be in the U.S. And I can't help but wonder how you will talk to Maudie about what it was like to be here when this particular country made a decision that does affect women.
Mm. Yes. One of my favorite podcasts, the New Yorker Fiction podcast. And recently it was David Sedaris reading George Saunders. And it was a George Saunders, I can't remember what the name of, I think it was called The Letter or anything. And it was basically the premise of the short story was that this older character, a grandfather, writing to his grandson, explaining how they got in this position. And it's basically set 10 years in the future. Mm. And it's really interesting, all of the apathy that one feel. He's explaining, like, you just don't think these things, it's possible to reverse them. You just don't think that that's going to happen. And we just, you know, we didn't get up to vote and we didn't go up to riot because we didn't think it was possible, you know, sitting in your apathy. And I do wonder, like, I came from a type of Britishness where politics was not discussed. Politics, you don't talk about politics or money. I like that, but it's absolutely not possible to live that way in this era, or it feels like that. I try and not discuss politics and money because, one, I'm surrounded by people who think similarly anyway. What I think about now, sorry, now I've gone on a complete ramble tangent. What I think about now is explaining to Maudie, like, how you can accommodate what people think they're experiencing in the world. How can people be experiencing something so differently and come to such a different conclusion? Like, what has gone wrong there for everyone? And how can you possibly try and understand? I don't know. There's no answer to that, but that would be what I'd want her to think about, to imagine or try and imagine that there might be a way of understanding rather than more division, rather than the like details, I guess.
You have this responsibility of this small child and her life unfolding in front of you. It's huge.
Mm.
And you've written this beautiful testament of an album, Patterns and Repeat, that I can't wait till she's old enough to understand it and listen to it and just revel in the fact that her mother wrote something so beautiful when she had just arrived in this world. So, Laura Marling, what a joy to talk to you. You are going to end today's FUV Live session with The Shadows, which has just a really interesting lyric. So someone was sleeping while she did her leaving. Cowards go in the night. And then she lives in the shadows of my heart. There's a haunting in this particular song, and I'm curious what that haunting might be.
I think what I was trying to capture was the sort of sense, the feeling of knowing that you can't be forgiven. Mm. Things that you've done that you can't be forgiven for, that are unforgivable, that have affected people's lives in ways that will never not affect them. And I think we're, you know, as you sort of trundle through this life, you have to accept that you will have done things like that, you know, in relationships, but like either romantic relationships or close personal relationships. And I think probably why that was provoked by having a child is because you think of all this innocence that they start with, and the way that other people are going to come into their lives and affect them, and they might affect others. And, you know, we're all just these fragile, impressionable beings, and things will, you know, change the course of our life not always for the better. And yes, yeah, so living with that, finding a place for that eternal, infernal.
Is there someone in your life that you would like to forgive that you feel that you haven't forgiven?
I think I'm pretty, you know, like I don't really live by the philosophy that you have to forgive people, because I think it can make them live on your mind. You know, like I think it's like a sort of perverse, in a way, it's like a resistance to just accept what it is and makes them live on your mind a bit more. But I think like you can really let things go. So I try and let things go. I try and not let things haunt me forever.
You just write it in a song.
That's right, yeah. I just exorcise it. Yeah.
Maudy is really lucky to have such cool parents. Congratulations, Laura Marling. The new album, Patterns and Repeat. My goodness, it has been such a privilege for me to have watched you over 16 years. It's really quite remarkable. Thank you. Thank you for that. We're going to end with The Shadows on FUV Live Sessions. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you so much.
So someone was sleeping while she did her leaving, and cowards go in the night. So she did her leaving, and how can I blame her? Who has the nerve to fight? She knows, of course she knows, that nothing will tear us apart. She lives in the shadows of my heart. I tried to persuade her in vain, of course later, that something that I denied. I knew it was better to say in my letter that I never even tried. She knows, of course she knows, and one day she'll tear me apart. This shadow that she left on my leaving, she's leaving my altar, she's leaving. Where will I go to pray? I want her, I need her, I long to believe her, words that she will not say. And I knew, of course I knew, that one day she'd tear me apart. This shadow that she'll leave on my heart. She's leaving my altar, she's leaving. Where will I go to hide? If she lives on the shadow,
that was Laura Marling performing and in conversation at WFUV in New York City. A big thanks to Laura for joining us in the studio, and to Chrysalis and Partisan Records, as well as Cosign. Thanks to our WFUV audio team, including Jim O'Hara, Aaron Merriman, and Zach Tomasi. Our FUV live studio sessions are engineered by Jim O'Hara. Our associate producers for this episode were Diana Juarez and Catherine Sherman. Megan Aftermat is our executive producer. Our theme music was composed by John Crick. Be sure to follow FUV Live Sessions wherever you get your podcasts, so you can listen to new episodes and find your next favorite artist or band. New episodes drop every Monday. You can also catch audio and video of FUV Live Sessions at WFUV.org. FUV Live Sessions is a production of WFUV in New York City. I'm your host and producer for this episode, Kara Manning.